This time, Ward was awake when Jason walked into the marshal's office. But he still had Matt McDonald in a cell. Matt was sleeping like a baby.
What's with him? Thought you were going to set him up on the wall.
Had him up and almost out a while back. Little turd kept trying to leave town, even after they lit the fires. Finally ended up cracking him over the head and dragging him back down here. The son of a gun's been out ever since. Want some coffee?
Sure, thanks.
I didn't make it. Mrs. Morelli come by and brewed it up.
Thank you, Olympia.
What you want me to do with him? Personally, I'm in favor of letting him out of the gate. Except we might have to let 4 or 5 Apaches in to make a fair trade.
Let's just keep him where he is for the meantime, all right? If he wakes up and starts getting all uppity again, get some of that sleeping powder from Doc Morelli and sneak it into his coffee. Doc won't mind so long as you tell him it's for good old Matthew.
You're the sheriff.
Unfortunately.
Why? What's going on out there?
Oh, you name it. My list got too long to remember.
The Apache ain't gone then?
I don't think so, but I can't see a dang thing through the smoke. What I think is that they're still out there waiting for the fire to burn itself out, which it will sooner or later.
You could be right, you know, Jason. Yes, sir, you sure could.
Ward, are you a godly man?
You mean, do I go to church of a Sunday at the Milchers?
No, I mean, do you believe in God?
Sure do. My mama would have tanned my hide if and I wasn't. Or didn't. I mean, wasn't.
Then start praying now. Make sure you pray for the right side. And stay in this jail. I don't want you trying to climb the wall yet. And again, if the Apache break through the wall and get in here, shoot yourself.
Jason.
I mean it. Don't let them get at you.
Right. You can count on me.
Outside on the street, Jason saw a large knot of grumbling men near the circled trade wagons, and he moved toward it.
Howdy, man.
You know who stopped the liquor, buddy?
I did, friend. I'm afraid we're going to have a few more Indians to fight today.
What makes you think that? Nobody's heard a peep out of them since the fires was lit.
Can you see them through the smoke?
Hell no. They all run away.
Just because you can't see them, that doesn't mean they aren't out there. We don't intend to take any chances.
And just who the hell are you to say what the town is or isn't gonna do?
Still smiling, Jason's right hand dropped to within reach of his gun, while his left thumbed aside his jacket lapel to reveal his badge.
I'm Jason Fury, the town sheriff.
Jason was vastly relieved when the men backed down and turned to head back to the stockade walls. Down at the McDonald place, Curly, hiding beneath the bunkhouse floor with the two other hands, Carlos and Wilmer, heard the footsteps above. The three of them froze at the first rustle, and Curly held his fingers to his lips before he silently blew out the lantern. They waited, sweating with nervous tension. Curly was mad, about as angry as he'd ever been in his life, but he tamped it back and held his tongue. He knew that there was enough kerosene up there, but if the Apache learned where they were hiding, they'd only have to crack open the hatch to pour enough flaming fuel through the crack to roast them alive. He wasn't going to die that way. All he could do was wait them out and pray that he and the hands wouldn't be discovered. And it would be a miracle if they made it up top with their heads still on their shoulders. At long last, it seemed his prayers for deliverance were answered. After what sounded like a kick to the stove, the Braves withdrew.
Wait. Give them a few minutes.
After 5 minutes had passed, he felt the boards above him. He was searching for heat, but there was none.
Listen, fellas. Apache usually burn everything they run across, and
see? They burned my whole village when I was a boy. Only 7. They are murderous pigs.
Whoa. Your mama. She make it?
My mamacita made me hide down the well.
Quiet!
And you too, Wilmer. They might have left somebody up there to catch us.
So now, we wait longer?
Yep. Give it just 5 more minutes, okay?
See?
Yeah.
Curly relaxed a little. He'd only made out 4 separate voices among the Apache, so they hadn't sent the whole mob. Probably just a scouting party who had found no one at the ranch, and probably assumed everybody was in town. Burning. Curly's stomach roiled at the thought. He didn't care so much about Mr. McDonald as he did about Miss Megan and Mrs. McDonald. But it was a terrible fate for anybody to burn up, especially to burn at an Apache's hand. He had seen it once, when he was young. It was why he was so cautious now. At last, he figured the 5 minutes were up, and it was time to face whatever was or was not out there.
Okay, Wilmer. Open it just a crack.
Slowly, Wilmer pushed aside the crossbeam and opened up the trap door about half an inch.
A little more.
Wilmer pushed it up another half inch. Enough that Curly could see the tipped-over stove, could see and smell its ashes, and smell the spilt kerosene. He could also hear the four Apache, who by the sound of things, had set the main house on fire.
Close her up, Wilmer. Those hoofbeats must have come from our own horses that we left up in the paddock. We're gonna be down here for a while longer.
Wilmer, who had seen and heard exactly what Curly had, was more than happy to comply. Outside, four braves watched the main house burning, watched the walls slowly go up in flame. But Cunning Dog wasn't as overjoyed as the others. There were many more things to burn here, a barn, a pump shed, a sleeping house. He sent Shy Colt, along with Cease Far, to learn if there was any livestock in the barn. If they could find no whites to kill, perhaps they might find cattle or horses to steal. Tipping Hawk he sent to set fire to the shed, while he went to take a torch from the house with which to set the worker's sleeping house ablaze. Shy Colt and Ceasefar came back with a milk cow, a calf, perhaps a week old, at her heels.
This was all?
Both braves nodded.
Kill the calf. We will eat.
Tipping Hawk had set it aflame, something the other two had neglected to do to the barn. But Shy Colt was now busy butchering the calf, while Ceasefar strained to hold back its frantic mother. Idiots. Still holding his torch, Cunning Dog started toward the sleeping house and started round it, setting flame to every protruding board he could find. By the time he had rounded it, the whole building, dry as the desert trees from which it had been built, was blazing, and the roof had caught. By that time, Tipping Hawk had jogged back up to the barn and set fire to that. Cunning Dog was satisfied. They had done their job and done it well. They had burned many buildings, and they had found three horses plus the cow to take. Life was good, and Lone Wolf would be pleased. The people in the town couldn't see it, for it was veiled by the still-rising smoke from their ditch. But the smoke rising from the south was obvious to Lone Wolf and those Apaches on the south side of the town. A few had cheered, but were quickly quieted. They had at least done some damage today. Lone Wolf hoped that besides Fiery Hair, there had been many white settlers at the ranch that his men had burned. He hoped they had all been tortured and had died in agony, screaming, even the women and children. He hoped the babies had been thrown against the walls of the houses or fences made of spikes, that their skulls had split open, and that their mothers had been made to watch as they died. He had far worse things planned for the townspeople, but it would be a good start. The smoke was just beginning to thin its cloak around the town. Perhaps this white trick would fade in time. He could wait. He had time. By 4 o'clock, the Apaches had gone, and Curly, Carlos, and Wilmer had nearly suffocated in the small cellar beneath the bunkhouse. But they had struggled out, fighting their way through the flames that still rose from all around them. No more roof, no more bunks. By the time they had made their way out into the yard, the house was nothing more than a pile of smoldering, smoking timber. The barn and shed were gone too. Judging by the tracks, the Apache had ridden their horses off and led the cow. At least, there were shod prints mingled with the unshod prints made by the Apache's ponies. Curly hoped that his horse Spin took it into his head to buck that brave, or braves if they were riding double, clear back to Texas, and right smack on top of a cactus.
Jenny!
From atop the platform affixed to the interior of the stockade, Jenny turned around.
What?
She looked irritated, Jason thought, but then he'd be too if he were her. She was obviously still upset with her marital situation, and had run away from it, something against her nature to begin with, to find herself thrust into the role of a soldier, rifle and all, defending the town's perimeter. She should be back east somewhere, attending Miss So-and-so's Academy of China Painting or some such. Not on the run from both a husband and a force of Apache warriors. But then, Jason's sister was a force of nature, wasn't she?
What is it, Jason?
He waved her over, and bless her heart, she came. Not happily, but she did.
Do me another favor, Jenny?
What is it?
Jenny, I want you to round up the womenfolk and have them get their old kitchen grease and household oil.
Why?
I want them to take it up on the wall and toss it over into the moat, you understand? The more they can scrape up, the better.
Any kind?
Anything. Beef fat, bacon grease, chicken fat, cooking oil, shortening, anything. Just collect it in wooden buckets, and when they're full, chuck them down into the moat.
All right.
Then Jason talked to some of the men from the freight wagons, and also most of the townsmen, asking them to gather everything slightly combustible that they might have. Axle grease, liniment, hair oil, hinge oil, and the like, and sent them on their way to make collections. Soon the smoke changed from dark gray to black, as buckets filled with everything from chicken grease to pig fat to horse liniment to hair oil were tossed over the fence and into the ditch. Jason watched fresh billows of smoke rise above the stockade.
That should hold them for the night, maybe in the morning too.
What the hell are you burning now?
Dinner grease. What are you doing out of the office?
I had to see the doc about our border. I picked up a little surprise for Matt.
Well, aren't you just a daisy?
Oh, and that's just how I'm going to think of myself. A regular flower.
They started toward the jailhouse. The wagon train.
You sure you don't see anything?
No, nothing. But then I'm a little nearsighted.
Both men were on horseback, and both had ridden down the Mormon Trail far ahead of the wagons. Mankiller was standing in his stirrups. He wasn't the nearsighted one, and he was certain that he'd seen a puff of smoke on the far horizon. Well, maybe it had been a cloud, or a mirage, but it had been something. Something that moved a bit, then faded away.
That'll be the wagons coming up.
We'll drop back and keep pace with them. And don't mention this to anybody, Randy, all right? Just keep those sharp eyes of yours peeled.
Right. I can keep my trap shut.
Randy reined his horse around. Blake, too, turned his mouth back toward the east alongside Randy Mankiller's. They began to jog back toward the nearing wagons.
You're a good man, Randy.
Try my best.
You succeed. Now, if I could only get you to be a God-fearing man.
Fat chance, Rev. My daddy reared me on all the gods of the Cherokee, and let me tell you, they're a colorful bunch. Yours don't stand a chance.
We'll see about that.
It didn't work out quite the way Jason had planned. The fires began to peter out at about 4 in the morning, and the men still up on the stockade were forced to start shooting at around 4:45, with the very first feeble rays of morning light. It started on the north side, and within 10 minutes of firing the first round, the townsmen had killed or wounded 16 braves. The Apache, however, had wounded 7 settlers and killed 1. The south side wasn't faring much better. Jason took no comfort in that, though. He was busy running from house to house, rousting out possible shooters who were still asleep, and making certain that the wounded made it to the livery. Doc Morelli was already busy tending the wounded. Jenny and Megan were already up on the wall, and had been responsible for putting 3 braves out of commission between them. Matt McDonald was up, awake, and driving Ward crazy. He was beginning to wish the Apache would break in, if only so he could take Jason's advice. At least he wouldn't have to listen to Matt's whining anymore. And also, so he'd finally have a good excuse to shoot himself and get away from his aching shoulder. It had begun to throb and pound with a vengeance during the night. But Matt was bound and determined to rant and rave about his lousy wife and his lousy brother-in-law and the lousy Indians. And a lot of other lousy things that Ward had managed not to listen to. Basically, Matt was determined to do anything but drink the secretly doctored coffee that Ward had handed him. Ward stared out the window at the town. As far as he could tell, just about everybody from town was up on the wall, including some of the women. The smoke had gone away, so he figured that the fires in the trench had finally gone out, which left them completely open, except for the stockade. Building the stockade hadn't been his idea. Jason was the one who pushed for it. And Ward remembered complaining long and loud about every log they cut up and down the creek and hauled back and set into the ground. Right now, though, that stockade was the best idea anybody had ever had in the whole history of everything. Ward saw Jason running across the square toward the office and threw open the door.
What is it?
Nothing. Just trying not to get shot.
Oh,
The second Jason jumped up on the boardwalk, when he was halfway through the door, an arrow caught him in the back.
Jason!
Ward dragged Jason through the door, slamming it behind him, and frantically rolled Jason's limp body on its side.
Oh, Jesus. He can't die now. He can't die ever.
The arrow was high in his back, over toward the left shoulder, and it didn't seem to Ward that Jason should be dead. But he was surely out, like the proverbial light.
Oh, great. Just great.
Splash him with water. That'll wake the bastard up.
Shut up, Matt.
Ward dragged Jason with his one good arm toward the second cell and its still unmade cot. The arrow didn't look like it was in too deep. He figured he could get it out with a yank and without having to call for the doc, he hoped. But first he had to get Jason's jacket and shirt off, which wouldn't be easy considering. With a shake of his head, he rifled his pocket for a knife, pulled one out, and opened it. It wasn't the best, but it would do, he figured. It'd have to. Carefully, he cut the shaft of the arrow away until only about 2 inches stuck out from Jason's back. Then he began cutting the material of Jason's vest and shirt away in a big circle around what remained of the arrow shaft.
Well, I'll be damned.
Most probably.
You shut your pie hole, McDonald.
Ward carefully eased the edge of his fingernail alongside the arrowhead, through the blood and tissue it had displaced, and before he had gone a quarter of an inch, slipped the edge of his fingernail under the inside of the arrowhead. He eased his finger and the arrowhead out. It released and rolled off Jason's back onto the floor. Ward sat frozen in disbelief, staring alternately at his hand and at the arrowhead on the floor and at Jason's back. Now that was a bloody miracle. Ward rounded up what he could for bandages, and after washing Jason's back, he tied cloth after cloth around the wound, circling Jason's shoulder and rounding his chest with the strips he'd made from tearing the thin wool blanket and the pillowcase in the cell. Finally, he rolled Jason into what he trusted was a comfortable position and left him alone, returning to the desk. He didn't know how long Jason would be out, but he also didn't want to try and rush his return to consciousness. He sat there for perhaps 5 minutes.
Oh, damn it.
Somebody was going to have to oversee things, and with Jason temporarily out of the picture, that somebody was him. Ward turned to McDonald, whose coffee cup, he noticed, was now half empty.
Don't wake him up!
Ward then let himself out of the office and onto the street. The noise was what hit him first, and the stench of gun smoke. He slowly turned, looking around the town and the wall that encircled it. The inner walls were thick with the forms of both townspeople and freighters, alternately firing and reloading. Some of the womenfolk were still up there, too. He could see Jason's sister, Matt McDonald's wife, and McDonald's sister, too, as well as Mrs. Morelli and Carrie Kendall, among others. He also spied Mayor Kendall across the way. Randall Nordstrom was on the roof of his store, lying on his belly, firing his rifle out toward the south. Saul Cohen lay stretched out flat on the roof of his house and store, peppering the Apache with rifle fire. Nordstrom and Saul gave Ward an idea, one he thought he might implement later if worse came to worst. He hoped that it wouldn't. He made his way through the town, his shoulder plaguing him more with each step he took, each rung of the ladder he climbed.
Jenny?
Yes, Ward?
Jenny, your brother was hit by an arrow, but I think he's gonna be okay.
Look out!
An arrow headed straight for Ward's temple, past him, and buried itself in Jenny's left wrist.
Oh God, Mrs. McDonald, you saved my life! Thank you, thank you. Here, let me tend to that.
Fortunately, it had passed straight through. He was able to break off the arrowhead and ease the shaft out the other side. It didn't bleed much, having been high enough up the wrist that it just passed through the fat on the outside. So he wrapped it up on the spot, using her handkerchief for a bandage.
That's fine, Ward. Now let me get back to what I was doing. I've got 11 so far. Don't stop a lady on a winning streak.
Truth be told, Ward admired Jenny. Admired her a lot more than he ought to, considering that she was the wife of the man he currently held locked in the jail. He aimed his pistol. How could somebody as nice and sweet and pretty as Jenny stay with a worthless cowflop like Matthew McDonald? Ward lined up another shot. Matt owned the bank and everything, and Ward supposed that he was pretty darn good looking if you were a lady, but still, Jenny didn't seem the type to be impressed by money or looks. But then, Who could figure women? Not him. He took up a stance beside her for a while, getting himself three Apache while he watched her for any signs that she was about to faint or throw up or something. But when she gave no indication of that, he finally moved on. Not only was she beautiful, she was as stoic as any man. What a girl. No, what a woman. He found Ezra Evans and his brother Joel down at the southeast corner, Ezra firing east and Joel firing south. The brothers had come with the wagon train before last and decided to stay on. Right now, Ward was mightily glad they had, despite his off-and-on quarrels with Ezra. Now, as he watched Ezra pick off first one mounted brave, then another, Ward decided that politics was a small thing for men to argue over. He vowed never to do it again, at least with Ezra. Ezra didn't see him as he climbed up, but Joel did. He held out a hand and helped him up the last step of the ladder.
Boys need some help? Though you look to be doing pretty good on your own.
Help's always appreciated.
It's most appreciated where it's needed most. A man would think these engines can take the hint and back the hell off. Why don't they just go home?
You got me. It seems to me we could hold off the whole Apache Nation with these walls. And Lord knows we got enough ammunition to last till next year.
Ward was lying, of course. They might have enough ammunition to last them a month or so, but they were fast running out of the men capable of using it to their advantage. And besides that, this last ladder he'd climbed had opened up his wound again. He felt the hot blood trickling down his back and side, and a fresh, heated ache where the arrow had taken him, but he tried not to think about it.
Man, you're bleeding! Fresh blood!
Oh, idiot! You got it open again! I thought Jason grounded you or something.
Well, till he got shot, he's over to the office out cold.
You get him seen too?
Weakly, Ward nodded. Suddenly, he couldn't seem to find the power to move his lips, let alone speak.
Ah, come on, Joel. Let's get him down to the dock. He's losing a lot of blood.
There might have been further conversation, but Ward didn't hear it. He passed out. The wagon train. Blake called a halt early, and the men began to gather wood, while the women got together the ingredients for the supper they would make. Becky Mankiller had her heart set on a rich rabbit stew, and Olin's wife agreed with her. But the men brought back three grouse and a black snake, not hearty fare for a party of their size, so Laura Blake broke out the last of their bacon. That, along with the wild game, made a passable meal when combined with the copious cornbread that Becky baked up and served with the wild honey they'd found a few days back. In fact, the Whaler boys ate an entire pan by themselves and started on a second. Later, after the dishes were done, the last coffee drunk, and everyone was in bed, Laura curled against Blake's side.
It was gone today, wasn't it? There wasn't any more.
Wasn't any more of what?
The smoke on the horizon.
What?
We may be women, but that doesn't make us stupid, you know. I saw the smoke, and so did Becky. And I woke early. There was more this morning before the dawn.
And how could you see it if it was before the dawn?
The smoke was very dark and much thicker than before. Opaque. The moonlight was enough to see by.
It could be several things, Laura. It could be wildfire.
It could be fury. Fury burning.
It's better not to worry your head, my dear. We'll find out soon enough. And I'm sure it's nothing. Nothing at all. Now go to sleep. Dawn comes quickly.
At about 5 that afternoon, about the same time that Blake and his travelers were sitting down to stew and cornbread, Doc Morelli stopped by Cohen's Hardware. He wanted to check on Rachel Cohen and perhaps change her bandages if need be. He found her and her boy still tucked into the store's first-floor storage room. Saul, she told him, was somewhere up on the wall. She was doing well, very well in fact, for having just lost a baby after a difficult delivery. Perhaps it was her good spirits and her faith in her husband that kept her going. Surely the constant sounds of shouting and gunfire couldn't be doing her any good. With this in mind, he left her with a paper filled with sleeping powders.
Take half of this if you need it, and the other half's for later. It'll make you sleep.
Thank you, Dr. Morelli, but I'd rather stay awake to worry about my husband and watch these naughty boys of mine.
I just saw Saul. He's a very brave man, Rachel.
Thank you. I know.
If there's nothing else, then I'm needed back at the hospital. The livery stables, I should say.
Thank you for stopping by. My prayers are with the fighting men.
And I'm certain they're appreciating them, ma'am.
Once he was outside, he was pleased to see that the gate still held, and also happy to hear that the incidents of gunfire seemed to have slackened off. As had the number of stray arrows sailing over the stockade. Were the Indians backing off for the day already? It seemed too early, but if they wanted to take the time off, he was more than happy to grant it to them. Although his primary objective was the stable, he dropped his bag inside the door. Then he made his way around the building and up to the scaffolding on the interior of the stockade. Carefully, he inched his way around the bodies of the men still fighting as he moved toward Saul Cohen.
Dr. Morelli, is it my Rachel? Is something
wrong? No, Saul. Nothing's wrong.
Saul signaled to him, and they both crouched down below the jagged opening of hand-hewn spikes at the top of the stockade.
You've seen her, then?
Yes, and she's doing quite well. I left some sleeping powder with her, which she refused to take. I gather she'd rather worry about you. Tonight, you make sure she takes a dose, all right? She needs the sleep.
I will be certain.
Is it just my imagination, or are the Indians actually going away?
Your guess is as good as mine, Doctor. For all I know, they may be planning to sing us to sleep, then sneak in and murder us all with the coda.
I've got to see to the men in the livery now, so take care of yourself.
Jenny Fury still kept her post on the platform, even though there were no Apaches to pick off at the moment. They sat below the sharpened pickets at the top of the stockade.
What do you think they're up to? Haven't had a decent target in over 10 minutes. You don't think they're actually quitting?
You mean turning tail? Heading for the hills? Hardly. I mean, there's still some light left to die by.
But then again, Jason always says that you can't outguess an Apache.
He's right about that, I'd say.
You said it was all right that I marry your brother, too.
That was a long time ago! Sorry, Jen. It was just that you seemed... I mean, the both of you seemed... Things were different.
I think they just seemed different. I think that Matt just made things seem different because he wanted to marry me, but not for my sake. I think he just wanted to show my brother that he could do whatever he wished, you know? And he surely showed him, didn't he?
Don't beat yourself up over it, baby. You were young and in love. People have done far worse things for only one of those reasons.
But not here. And not now, and not to my brother. I do love Jason, Megan. Love him more than anything or anyone else. He's my blood.
Jason's your brother, Jenny. Of course you care for him. But it's different when it's somebody else. Somebody like Matt.
Oh, rats. Well, you know what I mean.
How's your wrist?
Fine, thanks. Smarts a little, but what can a person expect? I'll make it up to Jason somehow. Somehow. I promise I will.
And you'll leave me to clean up after Matt?
Clean up after him? He's housebroken at least.
Barely.
On both sides of them, men were climbing down the ladders. They'd given up on Indian fighting for the evening, it seemed. But the girls held their posts, if only because of the conversation in which they were engaged.
Megan, I'm sorry. I'm sorry because he's your brother, and I know I shouldn't speak ill of him in front of you.
Speak ill all you want. He's a rotten son of a bitch, and I know it. It's just the way things are.
Megan!
Oh, Jenny, you sound like you're surprised. You've heard us fight. You've heard me call him far worse into his face.
All right, Megan.
You're not getting off that easy, Jenny. We'll talk about this later. But right now, I want to get myself a...
Out of nowhere, an Apache arrow sank into her neck. She toppled from the stockade.
Megan! Megan! Help! Dr. Morelli!
Over at the jail, Jason was just coming to. The first thing he noticed was that Matt McDonald was sleeping, judging by the snores coming from the next cell. The second thing he noticed was that his shoulder hurt. Not much, but enough that he felt a sharp, smarting pinch when he tried to sit up. And he seemed to have been bandaged by a one-armed, nearsighted monkey with his blanket, or at least pieces of it. He managed to swing himself up into a sitting position, then lever himself up to stand. None of it was easy, considering how he was wrapped up. As soon as he found his hat, he was going to find Doc Morelli and let him sort it out. He had his hat on and was clear out the door before he realized that the sound of gunfire was distinctly absent from the air. That stopped him in his tracks. Also, the men from the wagon circling the town square were gathered around the big campfire, where Olympia Morelli, bless her heart, was overseeing the turning of a big spit on which was skewered a sizzling side of beef. Raleigh Bigston, still swathed in bandages, was open for business. Abigail Krimp could be seen through the windows behind the bar, dressed in bright blue shiny satin, pulling and serving drinks as fast as she could to the wall-to-wall crowd. It wasn't quite dark, yet there was no one up on the walls that he could see. No sounds of gunfire, no signs of flying arrows or Apache trying to climb the walls or set the stockade on fire. Something was wrong.
Jason! Jason Fury, quick! Come here!
Jason took off at a dead run and reached Morelli's side in a matter of seconds.
What is it? What's wrong?
Jenny burst from behind the doctor and threw her arms about Jason.
It's my fault. It's my fault, Jason.
No, it isn't, Jenny. It's Megan, Jason. She's hurt.
Carefully, Jason peeled Jenny from his chest and moved past her, following Morelli back through the stable. There, on a small white cot, lay his girl. Her neck was bandaged, and the bandages were soaked with blood and fluid. His legs suddenly felt like jelly, and he sat down on the edge of her cot without willing it.
Megan. Megan.
He lifted her hand to his lips and brushed a kiss over it. She didn't wake. He lifted his gaze to Morelli.
Is she going to...
Hard to tell right now, but I think she'll make it, Jason. She's as hard to kill as you are. And don't even think about going anywhere until I get a chance to take those old wool bandages off you, take a good look and clean the wound, and then get you wrapped in some good clean cotton swathing.
Right.
Jason had eyes for no one but Megan right now, and no feelings except those for Megan and the girl who clung to his side, his little Jenny, his little sister. How had everything turned out so wrong? Why did his father have to die not even halfway here, the victim of a Comanche arrow? Why did they have to settle here in what appeared to be Apache and bandit country? And why did Matt's father have to be the one to tumble down a mountainside to his death when it could just as easily have been Matt? Jason figured that old Hamish wouldn't have been nearly as much trouble to contend with as his spoiled son. Of course, things always worked out better in hindsight, didn't they? Eventually, Dr. Morelli wheeled over a makeshift cart with bandages and ointments and so on, and began to go to work on Jason's wound, such as it was.
Hardly grazed you.
He unwrapped a good half blanket's worth of dressing from Jason's shoulder, which Jason had to admit made moving much easier. Then he made Jason take off his vest and shirt, cut full of holes though they were, so that he could carefully wash and medicate his wound. He rebandaged Jason with a quarter of the material he'd been originally strapped with. This time, however, the dressing was soft, clean, cotton bandages, instead of the scratchy wool stuff. And lastly, despite Jason's rather vigorous protests to the contrary, Doc gave him a dose of laudanum, putting him down for the count. Lone Wolf carved another thick slice off the roasting carcass of the cow his scouts had brought in. He had already assigned the three horses to braves whose mounts had been shot out from beneath them. It was now past sunset, and all he could see of the town was a flicker of light through the stockade. He had called his men back early. They were taking far too many casualties compared to the whites he saw dropping from the walls. At first, he thought that perhaps he and his warriors were beaten, and that they should just go home. But that would be a bad thing, to go home empty-handed and with so many wounded, so many dead. He remembered a farm, a large one, he had seen while scouting up north of the town last season. It was a farm with many cattle and goats that they could drive off, and what men he had seen were old, very old. He was thinking that perhaps they would ride north in the morning, all of them. They would kill these settlers and take their livestock. It would be simple, for there were only the two old men and a few women, two of them young enough for his braves to take some pleasure with. Plus, riding to the north might bring the townspeople out of their fortress and into the open. More than anything, he wanted them in the open, where his men could see to shoot, and where they might take trophies, jewelry, watches, shirts, hands, private parts, and many horses and cattle. He turned to the brave next to him.
Tell the men to sleep well. Tomorrow we ride north. There will be a battle, of this I am certain, and it will be fairly matched. Tell them!
The brave nodded and ran to tell the next knot of warriors the news. Tomorrow would be better. Tomorrow they would ride on the wings of the eagle and make war with an enemy who did not hide behind walls made of pointed logs. Tomorrow they would be victorious. Saul sat at home at his wife's bedside while his boys played checkers on the floor. He had talked about his day, although he had left out the more grisly parts, not only because he didn't want the boys to hear, but because he didn't wish to put more worry on his Rachel than necessary. He felt that she was very fragile now, and was hardly up to hearing the details. He had made their dinner, and now he gathered up the plates and silverware and carried them upstairs to wash later. Under the circumstances, he felt no need to rush things. But halfway up the stairs, he stopped stock still. They hadn't heard a word from the Mortons for days. Someone should ride up there. Someone should ride up and bring them into town. But who? Most of the town's good men were down for the moment. Some of their good men were dead, if the truth be told. He thought of Gil Collins, who they thought had died once before, not long after they settled in Fury, but who'd rallied and come back, only to be injured again by this most recent batch of Apache cutthroats. Batch? It was a whole army. And cutthroats was too kind a word. He forced himself to move again and told himself he mustn't think about the Morton clan. He made it clear to the top of the stairs before he stopped again, and then he went to the sink. He stood there a long time, his hands balancing his weight on the edge of the sink, his head down. He detested moral dilemmas. They made his head hurt, and his stomach too. But then he realized that he didn't have to go through all this inner struggle. Why should the business of the town be the problem of a mere shop owner? Jason, this should be something for the sheriff to decide, shouldn't it? Of course it should. A great burden was suddenly lifted from his shoulders, and Saul practically jogged down the steps.
I'll be back in a few minutes, Rachel.
And scooted out the front door. It took him several stops to locate Jason, but he finally found him at the livery, arguing with Doc Morelli, over the stew of all things.
We keep this up, we're gonna run out of beef to slaughter. So, what can I do for you?
I just remembered. The Mortons. Nobody's heard from them in days. Well, you asked. I just told it.
And you were right.
Jason leaned down over the cot and lifted the hand of the woman. Saul could tell she was a woman at least, and kissed it.
Is it his sister?
No, it's Megan McDonald. Caught an arrow in the neck. It's not so bad as you might think. Jason knows this.
Jason stood up, and it was then that Saul saw Jenny was there too, standing behind him in the shadows.
Don't worry, Jason. I'll stay with her.
I appreciate it. You have my shirt back?
Don't put that filthy thing on again, Jason. Stop by the house and pick up something fresh.
All right, boss. Won't be long. Thanks, Doc.
Morelli nodded in acknowledgement, and before he knew it, Saul was on the street with Jason, walking up toward Jason's house. It took only a minute before Jason came out of his bedroom, wearing a fresh shirt and vest, and pinned on his badge again, then started down toward the center of town again. Saul tagged at his heels like a puppy.
Go home, Saul. This is my job.
But Jason...
No. I'm gonna need to take some good men with me. But I'm also gonna need to leave some good men here in town. Got me?
Yes, Jason, I understand.
Get going then, buddy.
Jason rounded up 10 men, including himself and Ward Wanamaker, and a number of the wagon drivers. They spoke with the other settlers and learned that the northern attack force had withdrawn around the wall to camp with those on the south. Jason was relieved to hear this. The last thing he needed, to his mind, was to have to fight his way out of the town and then back into it. He was counting on the Apache being asleep for this little foray. They eased open the gate and exited the town single file, with Jason on his best mare, Cleo. She stood out in the moonlight, her golden palomino coloring glistening with reflected moonbeams, so Jason kept to the inside of the pack. Once they left the fortress town behind them and were a mile in the clear, they goosed their horses into a canter. It was light enough to see, and they reached the Morton farm in good time. Jason beat on the door until it was opened and was faced by old Zachary Morton, or rather, the barrel of his gun.
What the hell you doing out here, Jason? Waking honest folks in the middle of the night.
The door opened a little wider to reveal his wife, Susanna, at his side.
Miss Morton, we came to get you folks and take you into town. We've been beset by Apache, and I got a feeling they'll be headed this way next, since they can't get past our walls.
Well, we've been seeing the smoke rise. Susanna, you go wake the gals and tell them to gather what precious things they got. None of this may be here when we come back. And wake Ezekiel and Eliza, too. I'll get the horses.
Don't you think you better get dressed first?
Jason pointed at Zachary's nightdress and the scarf wrapped around his chin to protect his long gray beard. This, at last, forced a quick grin from Zachary.
Thank you, Jason. Be with you in a minute.
Right. Ward, take some of these men and hitch up the Morton's two wagons. Let out their cattle and goats while you're at it, and chase them off to the hills up northeast.
Zachary ain't gonna be happy.
Well, Zach will be happier rounding them up again than finding them butchered.
By the time Ward drove up the first wagon, Ezekiel and Eliza were coming out the front door and hustling Electa and Europa between them. Both Electa and her sister Europa, the widow of Milton Griggs, who was to be the town's blacksmith, carried armloads of school books, for both Morton girls taught school in town. Their mother, Eliza, carried a large paper globe, in addition to a box of what Jason assumed were her treasures. The second wagon came up straight away, and Jason saw Zachary and Susanna up into it. Zachary had brought a rifle and a case full of gunsmithing tools, Jason supposed, and Susanna carried the fry pans and roaster and knives and loaf pans temporarily wrapped in dresses and bed linens and layers of raw yard goods. Behind him in the dark, Jason heard their livestock being herded away from the farm. The Mortons always called the place their farm rather than ranch. They did grow their own hay and grain along the riverbank. Mostly, though, what they were interested in was livestock. His men were presently herding off some nice Angora goats, along with the last of the Morgans that Matt McDonald's father had brought out, and which Matt didn't seem to want. There were about a dozen head of cattle, and the men were driving off the hogs, too. He thought they had about 15, plus whatever litters they'd dropped this spring. There were mules and the saddle horses, too, followed by their big old dog, his tail wagging at the chance to do some unscheduled work. Jason hoped that they could run them out far enough that the Apache didn't catch them. Mostly because he hated the smell of roasting mule, and he knew that was what the Apache would do right away, to celebrate their victory.
Move out!
The wagon slowly began to move south. He knew the men moving the livestock would catch up in no time, once the livestock was safely hidden. And they did, after the main group had made 5 miles. Dusty Carmichael, another who had come to Fury with the freighter wagons, rode up alongside Jason.
You get them far away?
Yep, found a little box canyon about 7 or 8 miles from the ranch. Got them all settled in there, riding proper. Left the dog to watch over them.
Good.
The Morton's dog, called Old Chunk, was a very large and mostly white conglomeration of herding breeds. And he didn't just herd anything you told him to. No, sir. He protected those critters like they were his own puppies. No wolves or coyotes or cougars, not even a grizzly bear, would dare to bother them with Old Chunk around. The wagons and riders picked up some speed. They had only 2 miles to go before they made town. About a mile from town, they were riding at a trot when Jason heard some commotion up ahead.
God damn it! Pick a new place!
Jason galloped up to the front of the line, where Ward had been traveling, and found him still sitting his horse, but with a new arrow jutting from his shoulder.
Ooh. I swear, Jason, have I got some sort of target painted on me or something?
About five of the men had ridden out after the lone brave had fired the arrow, so Jason helped Ward down from his horse and into the back of one of the Mortons' wagons, the one with only two Mortons in it.
Ain't you gonna get the arrow out?
No, gonna leave it for Doc Morelli. Treating you is one of his favorite pastimes.
Oh, beans!
Jason tied Ward's horse's reins to the back of the wagon, and at last, the men who'd ridden out galloped back in. Jason didn't ask them whether they'd caught their prey. The fresh blood spraying from the hair grasped in one rider's hand was all the answer he needed.
All right, settle down. We're gonna ride fast for the two gate. Got it?
Ride fast they did. They made such a rattle and racket that they found the gates open for them and closed up right behind. Poor old Eliza was bounced halfway from her seat by the time they got the horses stopped. From there on out, Ezekiel said that was the ride that did his Eliza in. She had a minor stroke sometime while they were on their last frantic gallop into town, Doc Morelli later said, and thereafter got around on one crutch. Jason had the men park the wagons out back of his house, near the corral, and gave shelter to the Mortons in his home. He had three bedrooms, one for him, one for Jenny, and the third they had built on, in memory of his father. The Morton crew filled them up just fine. Of course, Jenny would have to sleep on the couch, if she slept at all. He sort of doubted she'd leave Megan's side, though. Those two were thicker than thieves. After thanking the men and seeing Ward off to the doctor, and looking in on Megan, who was asleep, along with Jenny in the chair beside her bed, he took himself over to the office. Matt was still sleeping. Jason thought that Matt ought to thank his lucky stars that he was sleeping so much from the dope Dr. Morelli was providing him. Otherwise, he'd most likely be dead, and it'd be Jason locked behind those bars sleeping on that cot. Of course, he'd been sleeping on a twin to Matt's cot for the last few nights anyway. Might as well make it official. He stopped himself just before he pulled the trigger. He didn't even remember pulling his sidearm. Didn't remember aiming it. He did remember the overwhelming glee he felt when his finger rode the trigger and the gun was aimed at Matthew's skull, however, followed immediately by a sharp rush of guilt. That was generally the way it was when it came to his relationship with Matt. It teetered precariously between culpable loathing and downright abject hatred. Lately, the last one was winning out. Quite a bit more than he would have liked. He didn't want to hate anybody, except maybe some of those Apache out there right now. But he especially hadn't wanted to hate his sister's husband, let alone the brother of his intended bride. Jenny was leaving him now, though, which was almost like giving Jason permission to hate him. Well, not really. God wasn't that good. He slumped down in the chair behind the desk and looked up at the clock. 10:33. Word ought to be getting around by now about the Mortons and what that meant. He slowly looked out and over the town. Lamplight began to glow behind formerly darkened windows. News was traveling all right, but he was beat. He found himself falling asleep where he sat and made himself stand up and walk to the empty cell. 2 minutes after lying down on the cot and tossing his hat aside, he was asleep and dreaming of a life back east, a life filled with school and books and clean clothing and steady meals and no Apache. Across the plaza inside the livery stable, Jenny sat, crouched next to Megan's bed, half asleep, under the watchful eye of Dr. Morelli. Megan was resting easier now, and he hoped that she'd continue to do so. The arrow had done terrible internal damage, but Jenny had gotten her here quickly, and he'd stitched her up the best he knew how. Now she was in God's hands, and her own. If she didn't jerk out the stitches, she'd make it. Morelli understood from Jason that Jenny had made the decision to leave her husband. He hadn't said anything, but he was happy for her. He could hardly bear to be in the same town with the man for 10 minutes. He couldn't imagine what it was like for Jenny to live with him. Poor little thing. Both Megan and Jenny, that is. They were very much alike. And Jason loved the both of them. He wondered why Jason hadn't wed Megan long ago. They were made for each other. This was clear. Perhaps it was that she was a McDonald. Morelli could see where that might be a stopping point for someone like Jason, but still, he didn't see why it should keep them apart now. They could still have holidays without inviting Matthew to the table. He smiled at himself a little. His eyes went to his newest patient, Ward Wanamaker. 3 separate times he'd had to patch that man up in less than 4 days. Or was it 3? 5? Quite honestly, he had lost count. He hadn't slept, outside of an occasional stolen 10 minutes here or a half hour there, and the days and nights were all running together. Anyway, he doped the deputy as much as he thought was safe, dug the arrowhead out as carefully as he could, stitched up the wound, and said goodnight. Ward was feeling no pain at the moment, but tomorrow he'd be feeling it, and he'd be a bear. Morelli wasn't looking forward to the coming day. Lone Wolf had sent out 2 braves to look for Hawkfingers when he didn't come back on time, and after he'd heard shots from far away in the direction that Hawkfingers had ridden. And he was saddened to see the 2 braves finally riding back at a slow jog, with the pony of Hawkfingers between them, and with Hawkfingers, blood covering his hairless scalped head and trailing slowly down his pony's side, strapped over it. Cunning Dog had just walked up beside Lone Wolf. Cunning Dog had led the party of men who had brought him 3 riding horses, along with a cow they had just eaten.
Who has done this thing? The whites? The Yuma?
Lone Wolf assumed he'd included the Yuma because Hawkfingers had been scalped. White men did not scalp in their experience. Lone Wolf had already decided that their experience with the whites was about to change.
Whites.
What will we do?
They will see to Hawkfingers. You come to my fire. We will talk.
Cunning Dog followed him curiously, but Lone Wolf had already made up his mind as to what he would do next. The whites would be sorry they had taken the lives of so many good Apache warriors. They would be sorry for those they had lamed and wounded and mutilated. Lone Wolf planned to make them sorry they were ever born, had ever traveled west. They would die screaming. Over at the sheriff's house, the Mortons slept fitfully, if only because they were not in their own beds. Zachary and Ezekiel both tossed and turned, worried about their livestock, worried about their home and their crops. Their wives, Susanna and Eliza, slept deeper than they did, but still fretted in their dreams, concerned about their kitchens and their families, and what tomorrow might bring. Eliza fretted less than Susanna, benumbed by her stroke, although it had been small. Her right arm had gone completely numb, and she would walk into walls, walk to her right, for weeks afterward, and she would forever use a crutch. Dr. Morelli had come to the house to see her and promised that she would be all right in time. All things healed in time, according to him, and for the time being he'd brought her a pair of crutches. Zachary and Susanna's girls, Electa and Europa, were restless in general. Europa had dreams of her late husband's death, and Electa dreamed of the children in their school, dreamt of the Apache storming in and killing them all most gruesomely. And they both dreamed of their poor Aunt Eliza, crippled for no good reason. Both girls, not girls now, but grown women in their 30s, one an old maid and one a widow, cried fitfully in their sleep. At around 4:30 in the morning, the Apache, led by Lone Wolf, began to make a slowly circuitous trip around the outskirts of the town, headed north toward the large farm Lone Wolf had spotted there some time ago. Although their numbers were greatly diminished since the start of the fight, Lone Wolf's men traveled silently and steadily, and soon they had put the town behind them. There were more than 100 in number, having left the wounded behind, as well as a small force to attack the south side of the settlement in the morning. He wanted the north side of town to think it was safe. He wanted them to send a force north, toward the flames and smoke of the buildings the Apache would burn. He would wait until first light to attack. The smoke couldn't be seen by the town at night, and he wanted it to be seen. He wondered if he and his men could hurt the farm people enough so that they might be heard from the town. He doubted it, but they would try anyway. He spoke to the man at his left, instructing him to drop out at the side of the trail. He was to wait nearby and to signal the next man when the whites were on their way. Another mile and he dropped off another man with the same instructions, and so on and so on. At last, he sighted the Morton farm, its large, well-constructed buildings picked out by the first feeble rays of the rising sun. He sent his men out to hide themselves behind crops, behind bushes, and behind rocks. He sent them to scatter their ponies behind the hill to the west. All men were armed with the weapons of silence, the arrow, the spear, the axe, the knife. They would wait for his signal to attack. Morning came early. At the same time the Apache attacked the Morton home and found it empty, the remainder of the Indians were attacking the walls of Fury. Those attacking Fury had little luck. Their numbers were few, and the men on the walls mowed them down without mercy. The truth was that the whites were tired and angry, tired of the constant onslaught and the interruption of their daily routines, and angry that the Apache had had the unmitigated nerve to attack them in the first place. And the braves at the Mortons? They found no one, not one person, not one head of livestock, nothing. All they found was a few buildings to burn and some crops. But the crops were too young and green to catch fire, and there was no one inside the flaming buildings to scream out. It was a failure, no matter how you looked at it. And Lone Wolf was not one to look on the sunny side of anything. They burned the house and the outbuildings, including the fine barn the brothers had worked so hard to complete, along with its store of baled hay and straw and bins of oats and corn. They destroyed everything they could that showed that a white had ever lived there, had ever thought of living there, or even thought of daring to pass by. Lone Wolf gained some degree of satisfaction from this, but not all he could have. There was no word from his scouts that the people from the town were on their way. Obviously, whoever lived here had been taken into the town along with their livestock before Lone Wolf thought to send someone to watch the way. There had been more than enough time for the town to notice their smoke. More than enough time for them to send help to the farm if they were going to send it at all. And they were not, he decided. He signaled for his braves' attention and then stepped up on a large rock.
The whites have tricked us! Shamed us, my brothers! We have burned their buildings, but the people and animals are gone! We will go back and attack the town from the north side and aid our brothers who storm it from the south! Tonight! We will dance on their bones, for today they will all perish to the last dog and tidiest child!